Welcome to the Culture of Things podcast with Brendan Rogers. This is a podcast where we talk all things culture, leadership and teamwork across business and sport.
To all our loyal listeners, the Culture of Things podcast will now have specific episodes produced for YouTube. To ensure you don't miss out on this exclusive YouTube content, head over to YouTube, click on the subscribe button, and hit the notification bell. Now, let's get into the episode.
This is my conversation with Alex Lee. Alex is a CEO, community leader, founder, ultramarathon runner, and a seriously great human being. Most importantly, he's a leader driven by his purpose to help people. During the conversation, we unpack how his life of service started with his own call to Kids Helpline when he was just 14 years old. We learn about his time helping refugees and asylum seekers and the challenges that come with it. How his work at KPMG, an opportunity to help people and falling in love, led him to his role as CEO of The Glen, an award-winning drug and alcohol rehabilitation centre. We talk about the influence of his mum, learn what gives him the courage to follow his purpose, the seventh generation principle, what the emu on the Glen's shirt signifies, and the legacy he hopes to leave. We also explore how his discipline, habits, and consistency led him to becoming the first Australian to run 10 marathons in 10 days, each under 4 hours, not to mention breaking the course record on the last day, his 10th marathon. At the end of the interview, I share my 3 key takeaways. I'll also share details on how you can see and learn about the significance of Alex's tattoos. Let me know what you think of the interview. Good, bad, or ugly, we love to get your feedback. This is the Culture of Things podcast. I'm Brendan Rogers. I hope you enjoy my conversation with Alex. Let's get into it. I'm really interested in your definition of purpose. What is purpose?
Purpose to me is the why and the drive behind any action or everything that you do. To me, that's a simple definition of purpose. For me, I make sure, everything that I do, there's purpose and meaning behind it. And when there is that meaning, I mean, life is simple and it's happy. Whether that's work, self-care, learning, everything. Once I know the reason and purpose behind it, there's actually less to think about.
Can you think back to when actually purpose became for you?
I think purpose for me, it would have started in my childhood, especially my teenage years. My story really starts from high school. You know, I started a high school where I didn't have many friends. A lot of my peers in my primary school didn't come to the same high school that I did. And so I was a bit of a loner, a bit isolated, and what that led to was a bit of bullying in my early days. So year 7 and 8, I had to figure things out and adapt to the situation. Spent a lot of time in the library, a lot of time by myself. I think I probably developed a lot of avoidance and running away. But it was towards when I was about 14 when I entered a very dark depression, which really started my journey of figuring out who I was and what my purpose in life was. I was depressed. I saw the school counselor. I saw the GP. My mum was a huge support for me. I'm very close with my mother. And the turning point was when I was really, really struggling. I think I had some issues with other people and relationships. And I was at a point where I really wanted to give up and, had some pretty harmful thoughts. And I called the Kids Helpline. At the time, I can't remember the number now, but I remember dialing the phone on the old phone.
The good old days.
The good old days. I called the Kids Helpline and it was just someone on the other line for 10 minutes, just really shared some rational thought and broke down what I was feeling and why. And it got me curious to try and just seek more help. I think just having someone who called, who picked up very quickly as well, gave me so much relief that there was, that broke my chain of thinking. And so I spent lots of time with my school counselor. I always often avoided the school counselor, but then that was when I started to see the counselor quite regularly. Through the sessions, the piece of advice that I always take on board was, Alex, if you want to, you know, kind of, you know, feel happy, you got to surround yourself with more happiness. I was like, that makes sense. You got to do happy things, surround yourself with, you know, positive things, positive people. You just need more positivity in life. And I kept working with a counselor. We know we did lots of exercises. She mapped out my week and we highlighted what was giving me positive energy, what wasn't. And that was when I started doing lots of community work. Obviously, at the time, I was very, very shy, and it took me, you know, I didn't want to do stuff with a lot of the things that she recommended in school and doing the volunteering through the school programs. I was like, no, I don't want to talk to people. I'll just find something myself. And so I just started doing Cleanup Australia days around my local area. I set one up in the local creek behind my house, set up a site. I was the only person who did it when I was 16 years old. But over the years, more and more people joined that site. I think the second year I did it, there was a couple who joined, a bit of an older couple. My brother joined, and then it just started building. And by the end of it, I think we had about probably 15, 20 people helping out, cleaning up the local rivers. And that's when I felt so much, you know, happiness and meaning in just helping the environment. So that's where it started.
When you look back at the relationship you had with the counsellor, what sort of thoughts, emotions, feelings does that bring for you?
Now, when I think back on it, it brings me joy. And I think that's when I guess I found that courage to ask for help and get it. And I see that as a positive turning point in my life. You know, to me, that was the change, because before that, what I remember from life before that was quite depressing, you know, no lack of self-confidence, no self-worth. I was always putting myself down. And so when I started talking to counselor, and I still see from since that day, I still see a counselor or a psychologist regularly. I still have self-doubt sometimes, but being able to talk to someone through it, work out, you know, my rational thoughts and getting help, I haven't looked back since then. So the emotions that I feel when I think back at that time, I think that was my turning point. And that's led me to, I guess, what I do now. I think between then, like when I started doing the community work and the volunteering, that just became part of my life. That became my purpose and happiness. Mm. Even through uni, through university, when I was studying full time, I still made the time to, you know, every weekend after uni, through the holiday breaks, volunteering has always been part of my life. Oftentimes people would ask me, you know, do you want to go to the party on the Friday? And I'm like, no, I'm volunteering on Saturday. And at the time I was like, well, that's a bit weird. You know, these are the uni days. These are the glory days. And I said, no, that's what I do. I got into a bit of a rhythm. I just tried to do everything. You know, once, you know, uni kicked in, there's a fresh start. I volunteered for, you know, mental health was a big passion of mine at the time. I really wanted to find out a lot more about mental health because of what I went through, the depression and bipolar and anxiety that I went through. I really wanted to figure out and learn more. So I volunteered to do lots of event management at Beyond Blue. I volunteered for this online forum through the Inspire Foundation, which is called Reach Out. So it was all about, you know, finding causes in, you know, that you're passionate about. And we did blogs and online videos and, you know, I love doing that. But then the other one, which was a really big part of my life, was helping refugees and asylum seekers settling into Australia. And at the time that I was getting bullied, I was actually getting bullied by a lot of new migrants who came to Australia. And it was often probably my fault at times, because I would spoke English well and often tease people. And I think my mouth at the time didn't contribute to reduce the bullying. So yeah, I worked with a lot of refugees and asylum seekers all through uni. I started on weekends. We had programs where we take people out on excursions, on camps. We had homework clubs. We worked at Villawood Detention Centre. You know, the organisation was a network. It was run by purely on volunteers. So I met some amazing people who dedicate their weekends and time to help. And often then that brings me back to what the counsellor said, you know, do you want to have a positive life? You've got to surround yourself with positive people. And I met an amazing crew of positive people there. I think that's why I prioritized it, because that was what made me feel good, but then also allowed me to help others as well. There's a huge benefit through mental health benefit through volunteering.
So just to be really clear, what is Alex Lee's purpose?
I would say my purpose is just helping people. I think everything I do now, always think of here how I can be helping people, how I can make sure that I'm in a good state of mind and at my best to be helping others, helping the community. Yeah, and because I know that that's my purpose, I'm always looking for opportunities to do that. You know, obviously my job is about helping people, but then also outside of work, all my hobbies and everything I do is just about helping people. And so when when things come into my life which isn't aligned to that purpose, it's actually quite easy for me to say no to it.
Give us an example.
Sometimes people ask to go out for dinner and I'll go along and, you know, everyone starts, you know, gasbagging and gossiping around the dinner table and I'm like, Jesus, this is actually not good for my mental health or, you know, helping me out. And oftentimes I'll decline invitations and if it doesn't really align with that. You know, if I get invited to things which, you know, time is precious. And if I get invited to things which I don't feel like align with my purpose, I'm going to say no to it.
We'll talk a bit about the Glen moving forward, but pre that, is there a moment that in all of that volunteering you'd done even before volunteering at the Glen, before coming CEO then, that really sticks in your mind as that solidifying moment of this is what I'm dedicating my life to, this helping people?
I think there were probably two big moments in my life. I think the first one was, you know, I was working full time at an accounting firm at KPMG, and I went up to my partner at the time and said, I want to take a career break. And I was like, sure, you know, what are you doing? And I said, I'm going to help set up some programs in the offshore detention centres between Christmas Island, but I'll spend a lot of time in Darwin as well at Northern Immigration Detention Centre. I told him I was going to volunteer to run activities, make sure the refugees and asylum seekers living in those centres were having a good program, they had activities, because I had an opportunity from the Department of Immigration at the time to help run a program there. And I guess, yeah, the partner looked at me just quite blankly and said, okay, Alex, sure. He's like,
so I guess, got nothing.
He said, oh, this is the first time, you know, someone's asked to do that, but we'll support you and, you know, you tell us when you want to come back. And I said, I think it's going to take about 9 to 12 months for me to set up these volunteer programs. I'll keep in touch and we'll, you know, I'll come back when I can. So that was a big turning point for me because I tossed that decision around in my head for a bit of time. I was working in a great place, you know, I was learning heaps, but this was also an opportunity for me to really, I think, make a difference. At the time, detention centres were getting very full. The, you know, Department of Immigration contacted me and obviously our team. And yeah, I think that was also when I got my first tattoo, which says live without fear. And I just jumped. And it was probably the most challenging, hard 9 months of my life. But I look back and I said, that was where I learned so much. You know, it was managing, you know, close to hundreds of volunteers who were, you know, spending weeks on end at detention centres volunteering. I was, you know, organising fundraising events at the same time as well. It was hard, but that was another big turning point when I knew that was what I wanted to do.
What was the hardest moment in that experience, that 9 months, 10 months?
Oh, I think at the time I was organising a big fundraising event at the same time because we were running on volunteers. And, you know, I was living between Darwin and Sydney, you know, kind of flying back and forth. And in Sydney, I was organizing these events. Then I'm in Darwin, I'm kind of, you know, running the volunteers there. You know, the hard part is, you know, I was early 20s at the time and learning how to manage people who weren't getting paid, hundreds of people. That was a huge challenge, you know, learning to motivate and inspire and keep people, what I always call keeping people's cups filled, dealing with stressful situations. And that was a huge challenge. Organizing the fundraising event for a new organization, you know, again, with volunteers, that was very difficult as well. I think the event management can be very stressful and juggling that all, yeah, while studying, not easy.
So how did you, given that situation and certainly understand leading volunteers and some of the mindset that goes with that. How did you fill their cup, so to speak?
Comes back to purpose. The first thing I needed to understand was their purpose and why they were volunteering. I think everyone comes in with different, their own whys. You know, I needed to figure out some were there really just to, you know, some come for as a social activity. Others will come because they want the kudos of doing charity work. There were others who generally had a deep-seated connection with refugees and asylum seekers. So really understanding their why and making sure we find the right opportunities and activities and things for them to do which aligned with their purpose, I think was really, really important. You know, so this, you know, others come, you know, those who come as it's a social activity and they want to just talk alone and hang out, you know, we make sure I might make that person the team leader who can touch base with everyone and have a chat and have a catch up and make sure everyone's, you know, doing okay. You know, someone who's a bit more shy but really can, you know, a bit more organized but really wants to do some of the hard work, put them into organizing programs. And we had uni students who came in and just to learn more. So we'll be teaching them things and letting them try and fail and try again. So really understanding people's purposes was for me was the most important part of managing them.
You mentioned your mum a bit earlier, and all mums are great, absolutely. But you mentioned your mum was a significant part of, you know, Alex Lee in his youth. What's that significance? Share a bit about that.
Yeah, so I'm very close with my mum. My mum's Heidi. I'll describe her as one of the most compassionate, selfless people I know. We're very close. We go for walks together. We've gone on holidays together. But she taught me, so my first job was with my mum. She worked on these harbour cruises in Sydney. I remember it was New Year's Eve. She goes, Alex, you know, come help me out on the boat. It's a public holiday. Come help out. You know, I was cleaning dishes, doing peeling carrots and potatoes. But, you know, she gave me an opportunity because at the time I needed to do a bit of work and make some money. But it was always the little walks back. You know, we finished work, you know, 2 a.m. and we walked back to, I think it was Central Station. And we walk past homeless people and she's always thinking about how she can help them and, you know, always gave me the perspective is, yeah, we can always help people. And that really caught, she always gets me curious to change my perspective on things.
There's a story that I know when I was doing a bit more research around you, we've known each other for a little while, but there was a lot I learnt. There's a lot of stuff. You're a private man, as you say, and you don't share a lot, not because you don't want to, you just keep things private. But there is a story I heard around coming across a homeless person that your mum asked you, I think, Alex, what do you see there? You want to tell us about that?
Yeah. So my mum asked me, yeah, what do you see? And I said, I see a homeless man. And, but then she changed my perspective because she goes, you know, she sees a beautiful human who might have just met, you know, had a bad chapter or made a bad decision. And I think that's, again, that comes back to purpose. You know, you look at something or someone, you don't just look at what you see. You've got to look at the whys or what's happened. And that has always implanted a bit of curiosity in my head to look at the why, and everyone's got a story. And yeah, she definitely kind of instilled that in me.
If this why thing, this purpose thing is so important, and you're living your life driven by this purpose, why do you think it's not seen to be that important by what would seem to be so many people in the world?
I think we live in a very busy world. You know, busy world, a lot of information. And I think it's not something that's really taught in school, right? We get taught a lot about the what and the how, but we never pause to think about the why. You know, I love reading books and love reading history. And once you kind of get to know everything, you can start seeing that behind everything we do and have in this world, there was a why behind it. And and understand the why, you can kind of see, you know, I guess you can see why it's there. Yeah, I think it's just the way where we're taught is, you know, at some point it got lost.
So you did work at KPMG for a number of years, 7 or 8 years, I think you'd said. How does KPMG and purpose and Alex Lee helping people come together?
Good question. I look back and think of how it came together as well. I think my route towards getting, working at KPMG was my kind of, I actually really do enjoy working with numbers.
I had no idea.
I found my strength. I love numbers. I love things organized. I really knew that in high school. I think in year 12, I actually found some old books the other day and I've got a 12 month study calendar of exactly what subjects, how many hours on what subject I'll be studying every single day between the start of year 12 to the HSC, which test papers I'll be doing. And I could do at least 10 years worth of trial papers before the actual HSC. And I had a bit of an organized, pedantic mindset.
What is your nickname?
The Organizer. Yeah, that was my nickname. My close friends gave me that nickname. Yeah.
Again, we've known each other for a while. You're a man of few words, but what you say is very meaningful. And I think that's a classic in your LinkedIn summary. The LinkedIn summary is a couple of sentences. One of them is I'm known, my nickname is The Organizer. I can't remember what the other thing was. It's something about numbers maybe or...
Yeah. I think it's, I'm The Organizer. I run ultramarathons.
That's what it was. Sorry. I'm The Organizer and I run ultramarathons for fun. That was it.
That's it. I think that sums up my life.
It does sum it. Shall we end this podcast now? But as we're talking, there's a lot of purpose behind those two statements.
Yeah, exactly. I think the being organized made me, that's kind of my way of dealing with my anxiety. I think through school, I learned that, always so anxious about the future. I had to put things down on paper and that really eased my anxiety. It might be over the top, but for me, that's what works for me. It's the thing about, you get anxious about stuff you can't control and then you're trying to control it a little bit. And for me, planning allows me to feel like I'm in a little bit of control. Obviously, now I learned that life always throws curveballs and plans got to adjust and I'm good at that, doing that as well. But KPMG, I love business studies, I loved economics, I love maths, and naturally, the safe option at the time. I think when you're in high school through uni, that was a career path that a lot of people took. You try and get in the big four, they're amazing places to learn. And I applied for summer internships. I got in and, a lot of people say that the big four accounting firms, they're really hard, you're going to work long hours. And I had this expectation of what it was going to be like. But when I got in, I met some of my favorite mentors and managers and leaders, like who I am now they laid the foundation and platform of who I am now. I learned so much of how to do things, how to manage people through working there. Yeah. They supported me through my career breaks and secondments and my wanting to do this and do that. They were so supportive. Looking back, there were some very, very long hours, but not having said that, those are the challenges and times where you just learn so much.
What do you think are those couple of things maybe that through that experience and that time at KPMG, a large organization globally, that has sort of stood you in good stead and carried you forward so well?
The big things are learning about being organized and coordinating. When I worked I had a 2-year secondment when I moved to KPMG London. I had some amazing opportunities to work for some global teams. I was working on some huge global audits, simply organizing a face-to-face meeting of, partners and managers across 32 countries was really hard. Different time zones and organizing different things and bringing all together flights, agendas, meetings, learning about calendar management was, time is obviously a very precious and valuable asset that we all have, and managing that well, managing priorities, learning what's important and what's not. I had some very, very driven mentors who made me learn how to do things efficiently and understanding processes. Think audit, living in the audit world for so many years, getting the opportunity to go into different companies and seeing how the money comes from the customer to how it ends up on a financial report. I actually found that very fascinating, and all the systems and hands that it goes through and making sure it's correct. You do learn about, everything in life is a process. Organizations are a complex system of different processes. And again, that comes back to understanding the why. You know, as customers, we can see things on the front, but there's a whole chain of processes and whys behind why things are the way they are.
You mentioned your career breaks through that sort of KPMG series. So my head goes straight to what was KPMG doing, or what was that environment not filling your cup because you needed to take career breaks?
Yeah. So I worked in financial services. I have to be honest, you know, very interesting industry, but it wasn't my passion. Mm. You know, I really wanted to, you know, get involved and learn about sectors which are helping people more directly. Mm. I love to learn, and I think that's what was missing in my life. You know, I still continued to volunteer when I was working full time at KPMG. I volunteered in wherever I was, in Sydney, in London. I ran volunteer programs whenever I could, but working full time, spending the amount of hours I was working, there were days when you forget about purpose. When I was entering the more assistant manager levels of in an accounting firm, there's lots of admin involved. There's a lot of things weren't as purposeful. I couldn't directly see the purpose of some things at the time. I loved teaching. I ran lots of workshops on the insurance sector and how that worked. But
sounds riveting, Alex.
I made it riveting.
I'm sure you did.
I tried to, because I love...
You are an out-of-the-box thinker as well.
Well, yeah, when I first started learning about insurance, you know, you watch the little video and you kind of... And someone talking on the video, I'd probably watch it 5 or 6 times to really get it. And I'm a visual learner, so I love to learn different ways to teach people. And so when I ran those insurance workshops, I used a mixture of whiteboards, of interesting videos. I love doing case studies. You know, I want to mix it, you know, and mix it up a bit. And so I ran those workshops because I put my hand up to say, I know I want to teach. I love teaching because I love helping people learn. But, you know, it gave me the opportunity to test different teaching techniques. But at the end of the day, the content wasn't my passion. You know, I knew a lot about insurance, but it wasn't the passion that wakes me up in the morning.
Well, Mark's an old insurance guy, and I can sort of hear him getting excited behind the curtains there. Just you talking about insurance gets him excited. So,
oh, we'll have to catch up afterwards. It's a big week in the insurance sector, Mark.
I think so.
Floods and COVID.
Mate, I'm really interested to know what has given you the courage to follow your purpose.
That's a good question. I think there's two things. I think one thing that has given me the courage is knowing I have that support network. When I took my career breaks, you know, I'll tell my mother and my father, my mum and dad, and they'll always support me, and they have supported me when I go off and volunteer. I also volunteered a year in Thailand, and obviously when I'm volunteering, I have not much income. And so, you know, my parents, I would always be, you know, go chase it, and you know, we're here if you need a place to sleep. And I think having the support network is one that gives me the courage and ability to chase that. I think the second one comes back to my story of you know, there was a time when I called that kids helpline and someone helped me. And if I now have that ability to help someone else, I know how important that is to, you know, that simple phone call really changed the trajectory of what I do now. And if I can help others, you know, do the same, that's what gets me excited about life.
So let's talk about the Glen, because apparently that fills your cup right now, has done for at least the last 8 years or so.
Yeah.
What's your role at the Glen?
So right now I'm the CEO of the Glen. We call it the Glen Group now because we have 2 rehab centers, a 35-bed facility for men and a 20-bed for women, you know, drug and alcohol. You know, we provide drug and alcohol rehabilitation, but it's holistic rehabilitation. So it's physical, mental, spiritual. And what I love so much about the Glen is how much the community is part of the healing and what we do. So just this morning, you know, we were planning on how we help all our neighbors through the flood cleanup. That's something that we've always done. And, you know, not only does it help by helping others, people actually helping themselves, if that makes sense. And community is a huge part of that. Yeah, it's hard to describe how important the community is, but it's the fabric of what makes the Glen work, and I just love it.
Can you unpack that a little bit more around helping the community actually helps yourself as well? What does that mean? Where have you seen that take place?
I think by helping others or helping community, people, it gives people an idea of what their strengths are and shows people that they have the ability to help others. I think that gives people a lot of self-worth, self-confidence. You know, there's times when we're sad in life and we look at ourselves like, I'm no good. But by giving people the opportunity to go out and do something good for others, getting a nice compliment can actually make people feel like, yeah, they've got value. I think feeling valued, feeling self-worth is a big contributor to kind of loving ourselves. And I think that's a really important part of mental health and our happiness.
How did your path and the Glen's path cross? How did this love affair start?
It crossed back in my KPMG days. So it was in my last year of working at KPMG. Well, it became the last year once I met the Glen.
But, you didn't go to the Glen thinking it was going to be your last year, did you?
No, but it did. So after returning from London, I got back to Sydney and I went back, you know, talked to my partner and said, really want to, you know, I'm back in financial services, but I really want to get into the not-for-profit sector. Maybe if I could work in that space, do some audits of charities, I'd love to do that. And opportunities didn't pop up at the time, but I just kept my head down, kept working. And then an opportunity did come. It was about April 2014. And there was an ad that came up through the Jarwin program. So the Jarwin program is a not-for-profit that connects corporate people with Aboriginal community-controlled organisations. So opportunity came up to head up to the Glen and work and help out with finances, budgeting, bit of reporting, 2 days a month and just do some volunteering. And so when the ad went up, no one in the firm signed up for it. And so the partner forwarded it to me because he knew that always hassled him about, you know, trying to get into the community sector doing some work. And so he supported to me as like, Alex, you know, check this out. If you're keen, you know, you can head off. And I said, oh, it starts in 3 weeks. I'm like, yeah, just go check it out. And so I came up to the Glen and went to the Jarwin induction for a week, came up to the Central Coast. I don't come up to the Central Coast much. So I got dropped off at Tuggerah Station. I thought I could walk from Tuggerah to the entrance. And then I was checking maps and I was like, oh gosh, I can't do this. So
we'll come back to that. Is that where your love affair for long distance running came in?
Yeah, kind of. But I kind of did a week of kind of camping and learning, visiting all the other organizations here on the Central Coast. And yeah, we got a tour of the Glen, and I spent a day up at the time at the Annex, which was the Glen's Hunter Valley site at the time. Met the board, and I'm going to have to say that first meeting with the board was when the love affair started. I think I heard all, you know, we were run by five very passionate Aboriginal women on the board, and learning about their stories of why they're on the board, that was it. I fell in love with their purpose. I felt the passion and the meaning behind what they stood for, why they were there, why they loved the Glen so much. You know, several of them, I'm sure, won't mind me disclosing, but have lost loved ones through drug and alcohol addiction. And their purpose for being on the board and part of the organization is to make sure the next generation doesn't go through the similar unnecessary suffering and pain that they've been through. And hearing all that, I was just all in how I could help. You know, I sat in that board meeting, I listened to their vision, their ideas, and started ticking in my head. The spreadsheet started in my head of how I could help, where I could add some value and really support them to help more people.
So the HSC came flooding back and all of a sudden you had an 8-year plan drawn up from how do I go from volunteering to the next step, to the next step, to the next step. And
yeah. I think if there was an image of my head, it would be lots of little spreadsheets floating around.
Overdrive. How did the Glen get its name?
So the Glen got its name. So I might start with the founder of the Glen was a man named Cyril Hennessy. He was a parole officer who worked in jails and saw a lot of people coming in and out of jail, not because they were bad people, but because they were sick. You know, they suffered from addiction issues, and he identified that because he suffered from some of his own. And unfortunately, his second son passed away from a drug overdose, and his name was Glenn Hennessy. And that's how the Glenn started. That was the motivation, the purpose, and the why behind why Cyril wanted to start the Glenn and make a change and offer an alternative to the incarcerated, to being incarcerated in the criminal justice system. He wanted to provide rehabilitation, you know, for people like Glenn and people who needed help.
Your involvement with the Glenn, so you've been there 8 years.
Yeah, just over 8 years since I first met the Glenn.
When you came in to the Glen, probably more when you became, I guess, an employee of the Glen. What's driven you? We know the helping people and we know the purpose, but what's driven you and the change you want to see in your involvement and your influence through being involved?
I think what's driven me is, I mean, I think it always comes back. It comes back to the clients. I think what drives me always is meeting the new clients. Seeing them is always what drives me to improve. If I look at all the projects and achievements of the last 8 years, it's always about how we can continue to service the clients better, if that makes sense. So we say that we're providing physical, mental, and spiritual healing. So how can we, you know, improve a bit in each of those categories constantly? So for example, even in physical, you know, small little projects like upgrading the gym, offering better food, you know, having, you know, more organized personal training classes, going out for sport. I think that's, you know, it's always about what the needs of the clients are to keep me driven. Finding more opportunities to help people. We get so many people reaching out to the Glen for help. The data showed in last month that over 170 people applied to kind of come into our centres. That's 170 people who are suffering, who are needing help, who are putting their hand up to change. And obviously, the rehab centres can't service them all. So I'm always trying to think of ways about how we can be helping them in some way or another. Whether that's referring them to another service, providing some kind of counseling, some outreach support, making sure we're supporting them. But then the people who do get into rehab, making sure we're doing the best job that we can to make sure that they come in and they don't need our service again. So in a nutshell, what drives me is the clients, making sure. I love hearing the stories of ex-clients, you know, 3 or 4 years down the track. You know, one of the guys messaged me who was here 2 years ago the other day and told me he's buying his house, you know, buying his first house. He's got his kids back in his life, and that's what drives me. And I love hearing the stories, and if we can keep getting better.
There's many fantastic stories, isn't there?
All the time, you know. If we can keep getting, you know, I'm driven to keep improving to make sure that we can keep getting and hearing more and more of those stories.
Yeah, one of those success stories was Ethan, who was a guest on a number of podcasts ago. We spoke to him, and fantastic. And you know, another person speaking unbelievably highly of the Glen and what they've done for him and where he's going to now and where he'll go into the future. So something to be very, very proud of, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. You know, we're friends, we're running buddies, we're flatmates. We still message each other. Yeah, he's an amazing story, and to hear everything that he's doing now, it's just... Yeah, I kind of get speechless. You know, it's so awesome to see, you know, him finding his purpose and seeing him do well. You know, I know his family as well. I know how proud Donna and Donna of him. I think it's awesome.
Our interview will continue after this. An expression of gratitude or reciprocity, no matter how large or small, is an important part of a healthy culture and relationships. Our friends at Jangler have a great app that allows you to send a gift card with either a personal video, voice message, or funny GIF. You can send it right away or schedule to send on the perfect day and time, so it can be something you set and forget. It's perfect for clients, employees, birthdays, and any celebration where you can't be there in person. It's quick, easy to send, and you can spend instantly in-store or online when you receive a card. Check it out at www.jangler.com.au. That's www.jangler.com.au.
How do you make that would have to be unbelievable decision on who doesn't get into the Glen? How do you make that?
On the surface level, we do have some criteria on who gets in to make sure that we run a safe centre. You know, we always make sure that, you know, being in a 35 or 20 bed facility, we need to make sure that we provide a safe environment. So there are some certain types of criteria. We want to make sure that the clients that we are the right service that are supporting the clients that do come in. Obviously, we're not a service that has the be all. We can't be the everything for everyone, if that makes sense. You know, we don't have full-time psychologists or doctors and nurses, and our program is what we call a bit of a, it's run on community and stakeholders and volunteers. And so, yeah, we've got to work out who's the right fit for our service. And at the moment, you know, we're still very full. And like I said before, when we're not the right fit, we still want to provide some kind of help, whether that's online group counseling sessions. We have our outreach workers. We have some amazing partnerships with a lot of other rehabs in this sector. So if they're not right for us, we want to make sure we refer them to others. If there's places where, if there's gaps in the sector where there needs to be a service that's, you know, or organization that services a particular group, then we're out there and helping and lobbying together. I think when services work together to help fill the needs and gaps, that's when we're all working well.
What sort of advice do you give clients? And again, I know you're the CEO, and there's lots of people in the organization that are interacting with clients, but what advice do you give, or what advice do you give the people you're leading in how you help these people, the men and women of the Glen that come in that are frankly lost, and how do you help them find their purpose and their path in life?
I think it comes back to our whole, I guess, model of care. I think we take a very strength-based approach to how we help people. It's getting people to realize that now, for us, everyone's got strengths and abilities. It's helping them, giving people opportunity to share their skills, their gifts or abilities with each other. I think that's probably the starting point, is for people to help realize what they're good at. I think that gives people their self-worth and their self-value and confidence. I think that's a huge starting point. You know, finding purpose is hard. I think it takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of trying. I think that's probably the second part, is just to try, to have a go. You know, life, for me, I always think, you know, I always love to give everything a go, you know, a try. And that's how you start to realize what you like and what you don't like, what you're good at, what you're not good at. When I was in school, I never played team sport. I was always playing the most individual sport where I didn't need to talk to people. So it's swimming, swimming and library.
Now look at you doing podcasts, talking to thousands.
you know, this is, you know, and this is a good example of giving everything a go, stepping outside your comfort zone. I really struggled with public speaking. You know, 5 years ago, if you asked me to go on podcasts, I'll probably just break into a ball of anxiety and finding
excuse why I
to
waited,
say no.
That's why I waited 5 years, mate.
I think that's the second one. Is just try everything. You know, when I first started at the Glen, I tried playing touch footy, and then that's when it really solidified my notion that I don't like team sports.
And the team doesn't like you to be on their team either.
Yeah. I mean, just giving everything a go. There's no such, to me in life, there's no such thing as failing, only learning. And if you do enjoy doing something, then and it gives you confidence and makes you feel good. Yeah, you keep doing it and keep consistent.
That no failing, only learning, and even just what you said there about consistency. there's something, again, that you'd said somewhere. I've never heard you say this, but I know that you live and breathe it. It's actually not what you say. And there was something I found about your words, discipline leads to habits, habits lead to consistency, and consistency leads to growth. That's profound. How the hell did you come up with it?
I must have Googled it somewhere. I think, you know, I draw a lot of my inspiration and motivation from books and podcasts. And I think that was one I must have read somewhere.
What does it mean to you?
Well, the first point about discipline, I think that's, to me, that's really, it's really important. And discipline again comes back to purpose. You know, I know my purpose is to help people, and to help people, I need to be the best version of myself all the time. Mm. And to be the best version of myself all the time, I need to be disciplined. Disciplined in looking after myself physically, mentally, and spiritually, because I'm no good to anyone if I'm not running well. And so discipline means, again, it's, you know, if I know that that's what I'm meant to do, discipline is saying no to a lot of things. It's making sure that I have a good routine that I stick to, and if things come my way and it's going to shake that routine a bit, yeah, I have to say no. When it comes to discipline, like, physical exercise is really important to me. Most mornings I go for a jog. Most weekends I do a bit of a longer run. And there's times when things come and try and, you know, can shake that routine a bit, and I need to make sure if I adjust, and if I can't adjust, I have to say no, because it's my habit and I know that that's what's going to help me be at my best. And once you start getting disciplined and start doing it, I find that my body gets into a bit of muscle memory, and it just keeps doing it. And that muscle memory is kind of what your habits are. And so now if I wake up and I don't even need to think about it, and my body kind of just puts on my joggers and goes for a run. Once you get into the habit of, and I love cooking. I learned cooking through my mum, and for me, going home and whipping up a really nice healthy meal for 15 minutes, like, that's just a habit now. You've heard this saying a lot, but we are creatures of habit, and we have a choice through discipline whether we make them good habits or bad habits. And you've got to be pretty disciplined to not stray away from that. And now there's so many distractions in life. There's times when I would, if I mentally get drained and I open up YouTube or Instagram and start going through reels, if I don't pull myself up and be disciplined, I can be on that thing for hours.
A lot of us can.
Yeah. And that then becomes a new habit. So I set little limits on how much I spend time on social media. I make sure I spend the right time on emails and don't, I mean, I could be spending 24/7 checking emails and reading and replying. So being very disciplined and blocking out time to work on my priorities and what's important. I think that's what, there's a start of discipline, but then you get into a bit of a habit. And once I think you get into the habit of doing the good things, the right things, and the important things, you just get into a bit of a flow. And so I know my flow, and I don't get distracted anymore.
We'll dive into a bit more of that and your running expertise soon. But before going to that, I just want to stick with the Glen. So you've been there a while, been the CEO a while. What are you most proud of?
Oh, there's so many things. I think the thing I'm most proud of is seeing now that, you know, after 8 years, there's a whole team of leaders and managers coming behind me. I've been very lucky to work with some amazing colleagues. They all know who they are, and seeing them now, oftentimes some of them run the rehab better than I run it, and I'm pretty proud of that. At the men's center, I mean, I look at our team and the staff members. Most of them are all fathers. Most of them have been through our program, and I think seeing them being positive role models for their kids, you know, I know all their kids as well. I think that's what I'm really proud of, is that making a generational impact. Sometimes I see them bring their kids and they're running around on the veranda and running into my office, and, you know, I love seeing that. Like, I think that's what makes me pretty proud.
Thinking about the clients, again, your experience over this time there and what you've seen, what holds specifically the client or the clients back from finding their way, finding their purpose?
I wouldn't say there's a single specific thing, but I think, you know, one thing that always sticks out to me is, you know, is the serenity prayer. You know, you got to accept the things you cannot change, and and I guess and then change the things you can. I think that comes back to that. I think a lot of people kind of, you know, often look at the outside world, what's external that's causing them the issues. But at the end of the day, the only thing that we can change is our own, how we react to the environment, how we respond, how we think, our own mindset. And that second part of the Serenity Prayer where it's, you know, you've got to have the courage to change the things you can. I think looking at ourselves internally and changing ourselves is the hard part. We can blame this, we can blame that, we can make excuses, but at the end of the day, the only person who can change us is ourselves. And I think looking internally can be very challenging and very hard. I think that's where courage plays a really, really important part. You know, there's a start. And it's you got to take full responsibility. You know, you got to take a lot of responsibility for yourselves and working out how you can change the way you think, how you respond to things, learning of positive ways to deal with situations. To me, I think that's a challenge for not just for our clients, but I think it's a challenge for everyone. The challenge, I mean, I find that to be a challenge every day as well. You know, when things don't go our way, it's like, oh, how, you know, I mean, if I look at this week alone, we get thrown lots of curveballs. You know, there's COVID, there's floods, there's, you know, there's sickness, there's under-resourcing, lots of stuff happening, but I can't control a lot of that, but we can control how we respond, how we deal with it. And I think when you get into that mindset of accepting and taking responsibility for how you adapt and deal with it, I think that's a starting point. We always say, there's a saying we have at the Glen here that we don't save lives, we don't change people. We just provide the environment for people to change themselves. And that's what they do. I think that's what the clients, when they come into the Glen, that's their journey, is their journey to work out. We provide a lot of tools and opportunities and they change. They do the changing. We have a little bit of influence, but they do it.
Unfortunately, the majority of people around the world, at least the research says, they're unhappy in their environments. You know, they could be happier in other environments. What advice would you give the masses, those that are listening to this or watching this, to help them on a path of finding whatever that, you know, good thing is, that thing that's going to fill their cup?
I think people who want to change their environment, I think it's starting off, I think it's about perspective. You know, I've been very lucky to travel to a lot of countries in this world. I've been to some of the most poorest regions, but there are people who can, yeah, I think happiness comes from within. I'm a pretty simple person. I don't have that many materialistic, I'm not that materialistic or have many things, but I think environment plays a part, but it's how you see it. I remember one time, it's just a quick story. I was living in London. I was living in a place called Battersea. And you have to kind of walk, you know, you get off at, I think it was South Clapham Station. You got to walk down this pretty dark road to get to our house. And at the time, you kind of got to walk through all the social housing blocks, and there's a few little ghettos and there's kids just mucking around on the street. And so I had a flatmate at the time who walked and said, oh, I hate walking down this street and I feel so it's a bit sketchy and I feel a bit scared and dangerous. But when I walked down, I just loved it. I loved the activity. I loved the laughter. I had actually ended up walking past I saw this house that was just always, you could hear the noise. You could hear people singing and it was just noisy. And I actually walked up and knocked in and checked it out. And I actually met, it was a little organization. It was called the Alays Network. It was a group of a Somali community center. You know, they'd have their prayers there. They have a little youth club. They play table tennis. And I just loved it. I actually ended up volunteering there and setting up a homework club and helped with some funding applications. But I always look at that because I look at that street. And for me, that was some of my most happy memories. But for someone else, it was always a bit, it was scary. And yeah, I think to change our environment, we can't change our environments. Now we can try. You know, humans, we always try to change our environments, but really if you change your mindset and change your perspective, I think that's where the starting point can be.
Well, let's hope everyone's got a mum like your mum, Heidi, who can help you change that perspective, because it sounds like a great example of the story you shared earlier, doesn't it, about the homeless person and what you see.
Yeah, exactly. And that's like with, it's how you see everything. It's how we see ourselves as well. Sometimes I'll look at myself and, you know, I'll put myself down. I'm like, I'm always anxious. I'm always so nervous. But I look back and I guess that anxiety actually helps me be a really good planner and organizer. Makes me, you know, a half decent, I can draw a half decent risk management plan as well with all the anxiety I have.
You could do anything Excel, mate.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
Classic. So I know that you will move on from the Glen at some point and maybe, you know, some point in the nearer future. What do you hope to achieve at the Glen before you go?
You know, I think the Glen will always be part of my life. So never see it as leaving. I think it'll always be, you know, the Glen coming to the Central Coast, the Glen has been my family here. Obviously my family's overseas and they'll always be part of me. So I'll never really see it as I'll be leaving. But what I do want to achieve is to just to make sure that it's in safe hands, whether that's through the right policies, the procedures, the right team, making sure that I guess the legacy I leave is that it's going to be, you know, there's going to be the right people and right structures to take it to the next level. I came in with some of my skills and background from the KPMG world, a few of my communities, you know, my volunteering world, and I feel like I've added my mark and, you know, left a few good I've left a few good things behind, a few good way things are done. But if I want to kind of, the biggest thing I want to achieve, yeah, is to make sure that there's the right people to take it even further.
Where does running fit into your life? Apart from being crap at team sports, so you had no other choice.
Exactly. Where can I be the most isolated? Running in the mountains.
Running away from people.
I mean, I've been doing bits of jogging and stuff through when I was at KPMG and at work. I did the City to Surf. I did little odd pieces of running. I don't even call myself a runner. I just call myself a bit of a fast jogger, I think. And it was always my way to relax. You know, if I'm having a bad day, I'll go out in the afternoon, go out for a jog. The weekend, might even just be a solid power walk. I mean, my mum loves, again, my mum's back in the scene. She loves going for walks, love bushwalking, and we often just go together. That's when we have lots of our deep and meaningful chats about life, about purpose, about death. Death always comes up as a bit of a topic.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah, and I think it's actually a really good thing. You know, some people find it weird, but we always talk about death and we actually practice our eulogies and stuff. And what she's always told me what songs she wants and hers, and I'll tell her what songs I want at mine. And I think
great to have that sort of preparation, I think, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Anxiety is squashed.
Yeah.
But I don't know, those chats actually make me remind me of purpose again, you know, what I want to be remembered for. But back to running. So running's just been a way for me to just to chill out, to de-stress, to gather my thoughts. Working in the drug and alcohol sector, my first few years, I found it really hard. In a residential facility, you're in a bit of an emotional bubble with clients, with staff. Emotions are high when there's constant crisis. There's there's stuff moving. There's so many moving parts to running a residential facility, a charity. It's a business. It's so many stakeholders. And so I always felt that at the start, my emotional, I generally thought I learned how to be emotionally balanced. But when I started working at the Glen, there were days my emotional center kind of went off course a bit. And I dealt with it through just running around the trails. The Central Coast has some beautiful, beautiful forests and national parks. And I know I found so much peace. And I love running on sand as well, and some beautiful beaches as well. Just running on the sand and watching the sunrise, it got me, you know, calm and centered again. And so, yeah, it's just a hobby. I did my first marathon in 2018, the Sydney Marathon. At the time, the running is a big part of the Glen program as well. We had a running group, and I really started getting more and more involved in running because as leaders as staff, we lead by example. And so we're talking to the clients about, you know, balance, about physical, mental, spiritual health. At the time of running, I wasn't at my physical best. I was a bit overweight. I wasn't doing much exercise. And so, yeah, I just started jogging. Yeah, 2018, I just started jogging, just enjoyed it. I think I did a half marathon. I think I did the Bay to Bay. And then September 2018, I did my first marathon.
You've done a few since then.
Yes.
So you are currently the only, you hold the Australian record. You're the only Australian to run 10 marathons in 10 days, sub 4 hours for every marathon. And you hold the record for the course on that marathon. And you did that on the last day, on the 10th marathon. How do you do that?
I'm not too sure.
There's got to be something, because not everyone does that.
I just enjoy running.
I've got these images of, like, Forrest Gump, just keep running, just keep running, just keep running. All of a sudden, you've run across America and not even realize it.
Yeah, well, that's kind of...
You just enjoy running.
Well, my missus, my wife, she called me Forrest Gump sometimes. And, you know, at the time, I'll be like, hey, I'll tell her, I'll message her. I said, I'm just going out for a run. She'll message me 8 hours later. She's,
where are you?
Are you back yet? I'm like, no, I'm still out. She's like, don't lie to me. And I'm serious. I have to take photos. I'm just out and I'll be home soon.
I mean, what is the discipline, you know, the habit forming, the consistency that's needed to even contemplate being able to achieve something like that?
I think it just... Once after I did my first marathon, I remember doing it. And at the end, I said, that wasn't too hard. I was, you know, because everyone, I guess we don't know until we try, right? And everyone, I pictured this marathon to be this really, really hard thing. They talk about this wall that you hit. You know, the last 10Ks of is always a bit, you know, there's a bit of suffering going on. It hurts a bit. But to me, it wasn't that bad. And so after my first marathon, I said, I'll sign up to do a couple more. I might do an ultra marathon. And, you know, 42Ks was all right. Maybe I'll try 50. Oh, 50Ks was actually not too bad too. And then I'll do a few more. And my running just started getting, I guess, longer and longer. You know, my training runs started getting longer. There's a curiosity in me that just loves exploring. So I explored all the tracks around the Central Coast, so, you know, the Great North Walk, and, you know, I've tried and find the fastest way that I can get to Sydney via the trails. So I'll leave my home, my mum's home, my parents' home in Epping, and start the Great North Walk there and just end up at the Hawkesbury. And then...
Is that a call to mum? Can you pick me up?
Then she'll be like, get the train. And just getting longer and longer and longer. And I guess my curiosity just started to see where this would end up. So I did, I found this, there's a website called Running Calendar, and I just see what events are on. And it was last year, 2021, where there was a 10 marathons in 10 days. I'm like, oh, this looks hard. I might give that a go. Because I do run most days, you know, sometimes it's 10K, sometimes it's 5, sometimes it's 20. And I was like, you know, I just want to see what it's like to run 10 marathons in 10 days. So last year I did it. It was a bit of guesswork, you know, guessing my nutrition, my how I'd feel, my dinner prep. It was all a bit of a experiment, I guess, to see if I could do it. And I guess I did it last year. But at the end I thought, oh, well, I could have probably prepped a bit better. I could have trained a bit better. I could have organized my aid stations a lot better. And so this year, I just want to see what I can actually do and just see my potential. And I think that curiosity to see what my potential landed this year to do 10 and 10 marathons. The 4 hours, actually, I'm part of a running club. It's called the Achilles Hunter Central Coast, which is a running club for people with, you know, vision impairment. And one of my running buddies, Shane.
You founded that.
Yeah. Yeah. So Shane... Alan is a good friend, said he got a ticket to run the New York Marathon, and he actually said he wants to do it under 4 hours. He said this a few years ago, and at the time I said, oh, 4 hours. I did my first marathon in 4 hours in like 15 minutes. I was like, oh, 4 hours. Well, I better try and get a bit quicker if I'm going to help him train. And so I slowly kind of got quicker, and I don't really train for speed. I just train for fun. I just run for fun. You know, like I said, running for me is a way to de-stress, and it helps me mentally probably more than it does physically. But I did want to test myself out physically just to see where I'm at. And so I made a goal to try and run the marathons under 4 hours. The first day was going to be my main day. If I could get the first day done under 4 hours, I knew I might be okay for the rest of it. So yeah, I planned my pace, I planned my nutrition, I planned my shoes, my clothes, I planned everything. I have an awesome spreadsheet.
I bet you could probably sell that spreadsheet.
Yeah, for anyone else who plays an Nintendo.
It might be a small market, right. But anyway.
Oh, well, anyone, I actually say anyone who wants to do it. Like, I love seeing other people run. When I'm not running on weekends, I'm volunteering at events because I just love seeing others reaching their potential as well.
How many other crazies go in that event?
I think we had five. Five who did all 10. Yeah, so we had five runners from all different parts. I don't know, did we have five? I think maybe had a few more than that. You know, there's different people who came and did different days. Some did 5 and 5 days, some did 7 and 7, others did 3. But yeah, I think there was five who finished all 10. Yeah. And I know they're crazy. I mean, people probably think I'm crazy too, but...
Well, actually, you're king of the crazies, mate, because you were the best crazy there.
I don't think I'm crazy. I just think I'm just like jogging. I'm just a casual jogger.
That keeps going and going and going.
Yeah.
Where's the off switch?
You know, the off switch nearly came to me throughout the middle of it. So my first 5 days, I had a very detailed plan that I would kind of just get a little bit quicker each day. You know, I knew from the first time I did it that, you know, how my body would react and where the sore points were and where I needed to look after myself. It was day 6 where I started getting a little bit tired, got a little bit fatigued for some reason on day 6.
After the 5 previous marathons. Yeah.
And it was a bit of mental fatigue because every kilometer I was keeping track of how fast I was going and I was, you know, the whole time I was running, there were some awesome mass calculations happening in my head of how much I needed to run and how far I had left and what pace I needed to do. And I just kind of got mentally fatigued by doing that. And so day 7, I just said to myself, look, I kind of gave myself an out and said, you run because it's your way to de-stress. It's your meditation. Just forget about trying to do it all under 4 hours and just enjoy it. And I think when I gave myself that out, I started enjoying myself a lot more without the pressure of looking at my watch, looking at my pace and doing things like that. And yeah, from day 7 onwards, I started getting my fastest, just out there enjoying it. And because it's stretch over 10 days, you don't know the weather conditions as well. So that was, some days it was pouring rain, other days it was hot, other days it was foggy, it was frosty, it was slippery. So yeah, day 7, I just let go of that, remembered my why, remembered my purpose, and just went out then just jogged and just started jogging faster and faster. And then on day 9 in the afternoon, we had a guy there called Michael Gentle who does all the recording. He records all these races, which is why I knew. And I checked with him first and said, I was like, hey, Michael, is there anyone else who has done these 10 marathons in 10 days under 4 hours? And he goes, just check the records. I haven't. And I'm sure someone has done something in the past similar, but maybe it hasn't been recorded at an event. And he goes, yeah. And he kind of gave me the challenge. Yeah, you know, the course record for this particular track is 3 hours and 32 minutes. And I was like, oh, no, I didn't know that. Might. And when I got home, I was like, day 10,
mind's ticking
got nothing
over.
To lose. I may as well give it a crack. And then I did this time. I did go. I knew that if I was to break this, I had to run every kilometer under 5 minutes. And yeah, I just, you know, ticked them at my watch and checked that I ran under 5 minutes each K, and yeah, did that and felt all right afterwards. So I finished in 3 hours and 31 minutes because I didn't want to go. Yeah, just stayed close to it.
What's the next challenge in the running map for Alex?
So the next challenge, so now I'm doing a lot more longer, I'm doing a few longer runs.
Yeah, they weren't long enough, those 420 odd kilometers in 10 days.
So I'm doing a few 100K, 100 mile runs. So when I talk to, you know, I love the people I run with. I think one of the big things of running 10 marathons in 10 days, you're running past your fellow runners constantly. And I think the camaraderie and support from them also was a huge factor in getting through it. You know, there's so much, you know, we had dinners together afterwards, we chat. And when you have five pretty crazy runners chatting, you come up with some crazy ideas. So, you know, there are, you know, I learned a lot from them of what's out there. You know, I learned about some 200 mile runs, which run annually. There's one called the Delirious West. That's the Irrational South. So I'm going to do one of them next year as well.
I happened to meet Pat Farmer a little while back, and again, people can look up you know, his credentials in the running space, and that's what's coming. If you don't know Matt, if you haven't met Pat before, you guys need to get together, and there'll be some even more crazier stuff coming up, I think.
The Central Coast has some of the best endurance athletes in this country. You know, I think the Terrigal Trotters, you know, I don't run with them often, but, you know, through the events and volunteering with the Glen and being part of, you know, there, you hear some just amazing, amazing running stories, which are...
And as you said before, there's such a great environment on the Central Coast, isn't it? It's a beautiful landscape, beautiful bushland, beautiful sea. It's beautiful.
There's everything. There's everything here.
Enough to take your mind off the pain, at least for a little time.
Yep. It does get, I mean, in hindsight, yeah, it does get painful.
I'm glad you're honest about that, mate.
Good pain. Yeah. Good pain. So if anyone thinks they can just wake up and do 10 marathons in 10 days, yeah, there's a bit of pain.
You'd advise against, pain and suffering. You'd advise against it? Do some training?
A little bit. Yeah. There's a couple of years in conditioning and training that goes into it.
You sort of mentioned a couple of times, maybe not use this word, sort of therapeutic around running and how therapeutic that is for you, you know, the de-stressing and part of your mental health requirement. What do you think you'd be like if you didn't find that outlet and how that would impact your ability to live this purpose-driven life?
I honestly couldn't imagine life without it now. I think we all have to find our own escape sometimes. You know, obviously working in the drug and alcohol space, you kind of see people often, and working from a corporate environment as well, I often see people try to escape stress through drinking, through drugs, through alcohol, through medication. And we all have to find our own little escape sometimes. I think for me, running is my escape. You know, I think time stops for me. And you know, when I'm running in beautiful bushland or across the beach and stuff, yeah, all my worries in the world just kind of disappear. If it wasn't running, I'd probably find some other avenue to do it. I actually find, I mean, besides running, there's probably a lot of other things which I subconsciously do where time stops as well. I mean, this sounds incredibly nerdy, but I can get lost on an Excel spreadsheet for hours. If I'm not running...
I think we've gathered that through this interview, mate.
If I'm not running, I'm building these awesome plans and spreadsheets and, you know, goal setting. When I'm not doing that, I'm reading a lot. I find reading and learning from, you know, soaking in the wisdom of past leaders and inspirational figures helps me escape as well. If I'm not doing that, I'm listening to some awesome podcasts, listening to audiobooks. And if I'm not doing that, I'm volunteering. You know, I'm volunteering and doing something positive and chatting to people. Volunteer for my local running club. I volunteer at running events. I still do my cleanups as well. You know, most recent one last year, we went through Aroombra State Forest and cleaned that up. So, yeah, I think it's always finding different hobbies which fill the cup. And for me, those are the hobbies which fill mine.
Volunteerism in Australia, the statistics are dropping. Less people are volunteering. It's been that way for a long time. Pull out your magic wand. How do you change that? Because you're doing enough for many people, but there's many people out there that, you know, it's not a priority for them.
Yeah, I think if there was a magic wand, I think it comes twofold. I think one is to reduce the barriers to volunteering, making it easier, you know, linking. I think I see a lot of things popping up where it's a little bit of a brokerage system of linking up people's passions with opportunities to volunteer. I think that needs to be easier. You know, I think we're heading to a space where so much kind of risk aversion or paperwork and all this kind of stuff involved. I think we've got to really look at reducing the barriers. I think there are people out there who really do want to help. I think it's human to help. I think within all of us, there's something there. And that belief, what I said before, that everyone's got strengths, everyone's got abilities that they can share, everyone's got their gifts and skills. I think if there was a way of the magic wand to reduce that barriers that link people with their right passions and pursuits, I think that would be a huge step forward in volunteering. But I think the second thing is just making volunteering more in the mainstream and selling some amazing, I hear so many amazing stories of people volunteering. You know, when you scroll through your social media feeds these days, there's a lot of gossip and negative news and stuff. I think if we share, you know, just sharing some more positive stories of volunteering and what it means and how it can help by helping others, you're helping yourself. I think that's what's going to inspire more people to get out there and just have a go. And I think that's, you know, that's a third thing as well, just having a go. People stepping forward, it's scary, you know, it's, you're doing something that's different, doing something that's uncomfortable, and you have to, you know, get out of your comfort zone sometimes. If you can help people, empower people to, you know, have the courage to step out their comfort zone and try something new, I think that's a good thing.
Let's link what you've just said back to that shirt of yours, the Glen and the emu on it. And I was saying before we recorded, I'd actually not realized the significance. I hadn't joined the dots about the emu on the shirt. Tell us about it.
So I'll share the story. So this is, you know, my colleague Chris Mason tells a story much better than I do.
Meso.
Big on Mick Meso. I love Meso. So I'm probably going to butcher it, but you'll have to.
He can give you feedback later.
But this is Dinawan, the emu, and this is our symbol for. And this artwork was done by Kylie Cassidy. This specific one was done for a sports tournament a few years ago, and now it's become the emblem of our running group.
I have to say, I'll just stop you once. Kylie's developing a bit of a name for herself on this podcast, mate, because Ethan shared his Rabbitohs tattoo and the design that Kylie had drawn.
Yep.
Well done, Kylie.
Yeah.
What a champion.
She's
awesome.
She's a beautiful person. We've known Kylie for years now, and she's been the artist. She started as the art teacher at the Glen. You know, she's got one of the biggest hearts I know, and now she's the chief operating officer of the Glen for Women. Yeah, incredible story as well with Kylie. So she drew this artwork, and the meaning behind it is, you know, on the coat of arms has, you know, two animals, a kangaroo and the emu, and they're there because they can't go backwards. And that's the philosophy of our running crew, always forwards and never backwards. And that's a reflection of a life at the Glen, I guess. It's looking forward, looking at the future challenges, goals. The past is the past, and we move forward. And these shirts, they're not given, they're always earned as well. So anyone who participates in the running crew has to do 3 training runs, and then they earn their shirt. That's the story, but Mesa can give me a bit of a score out of 10 for that one.
It's a great story.
Yeah.
When we think about that, and in relation to the Glen and formed on the basis of support for Aboriginal people going through drug and alcohol rehabilitation, how does the emu, how does it looking forward, given your experience working so closely within the Aboriginal culture and Aboriginal people, about looking forward? I ask that just on the premise that in what you're saying, I'm thinking there's so much looking back around Aboriginal culture and you know, what may have happened in Australia and all those sort of things. But what's the future about looking forward? I feel like there's more looking back than looking forward. What's your view, given that you're immersed in this situation?
Well, I'm very lucky to work in an environment at the Glen where it is about looking forward. Mm. You know, I think we do a lot of work with supporting clients to work with their past, but we balance it out by looking forward and supporting, empowering them to live the life that they want to live, giving them all the opportunities, you know, whatever that may be. You know, as you know, Meso runs all our cultural activities where there's opportunities to learn. We have our transition program where you can support clients into employment, into housing, getting qualifications. In general, I think it's, you know, Indigenous and non-Indigenous people. It's all, you know, looking forward is, I think that's life, you know, building the life that you want to live. And for us, it's just giving everyone opportunities to do that.
And ultimately, it doesn't matter what the situation is, you can change the future. You can't change the past.
Yeah, exactly. And I guess that comes back to that serenity prayer. You know, you got to accept the things you cannot change and the courage to change the things you can. And I think that's where, you know, I love working with our board and our team, because we're always about achieving our purpose, which is to keep helping more people better. And that's all about improvement, about drive, about one thing that always sticks in my mind, working with the Aboriginal community. So I'm very blessed and very grateful. I've got to work with a lot of people. And there's one of our board members once told me about the 7-generation principle. And what that is that the decisions of today you know, affect the next seven generations. And to me, there was like, that really embodies everything you just said. You know, that's totally future planning. It's about looking forward. And so when, you know, those pieces of wisdom, I think, you know, there's actually a lot to learn from that, is it's actually all about looking forward, and looking forward, not just short term, but looking forward way longer term than we do in our current society. Because that's what gives me purpose as well, is, you know, we might be helping one person now, but we're actually helping the next generation. We're helping their kids. We're helping their kids. We're helping grandkids. And so, yeah, that really sticks to me all the time. Yeah, the decisions of today affect the next seven generations. That's looking forward.
When you're on one of these walks with your mum, Heidi, you mentioned before about talk about what you'd like someone to say about you in your eulogy. So what do you want that someone to say about you?
He's an organized bloke who runs ultramarathons for fun.
Well, someone's already saying that about you. What else?
Oh, we have a laugh. I mean, we don't take, like, we actually joke around a lot. And I always joke around about things. I would say it hurts. She's like, no, don't you dare say that. But man,
What legacy do you want to leave?
Man, I just want to be I see myself as just a simple person who just really had a go at helping other people, helping others, you know, live a better life. But you know, working in the drug and alcohol sector, you see so much. I see so much unnecessary suffering and pain. And if I can live a life where I can help, you know, a couple of people live a happier life without as much suffering, I'm pretty stoked. I'm like you said before, I'm a very private person. I'm very low key. So yeah, I just want to make sure that at my funeral, people don't spend too much money. Keep it low key. Don't waste too much money on it.
And if they've got to spend, make sure it's tax deductible.
Yeah, make sure it's tax deductible. Find a cheap venue. I'm gone already. It's okay. Yeah, I'm really like that's, and I guess that's the conversation I have with my mum. Yeah, my legacy is just a simple bloke who just wanted to help out.
You're a lifelong learner. So, what has had, or who has had, the greatest impact on your leadership journey?
I've had a lot of mentors through life. If I look at every chapter of where I've helped in the refugee sector, at KPMG, you know, even the Somali community leaders, every person who I've learned from who's pushed me, I'll definitely remember, I guess, all the lessons. I can be my own worst enemy sometimes, and I don't see my own value. And I think the greatest mentors I've had are people who have seen my own, you know, seen the strength in me and my abilities, and have pushed me to reach my potential. I think at KPMG at the time when I worked with multiple partners. When I was there, I was you know, there sitting in the office. It's 9 o'clock. I'm eating a takeaway dinner. I'm like, oh, you know, I was challenged to the point where I was questioning whether I wanted to do this. But I realized that some of these projects that I'm working on, I look back at now, I learned so much from them. And the partners that I work with just challenged me to be at my best. You know, when I was working in the detention centers, I had a mentor there who was always giving me advice on how to run events, how to coordinate things, how to, you know, work with volunteers. Everything I learned there, I walk away with. You know, now working at the Glen, and you know, working with Joe for the last 8 years and the board, you know, they always challenge me and push me. They make sure I'm doing things the right way and the best way. Now, at times it's stressful, but I know that they are, you know, having so many mentors in life, I know that it comes from a good place. It comes from a kind place. It comes from a place where they want to be helping more people, helping the Glen, helping clients. It comes from there. They want you to make sure I'm at my best, I reach my potential, and I'm always getting challenged and learning. Yeah. And so I think, you know, I've had a lot of mentors. I mean, when I don't have, you know, mentors live, all the books I read are mentors as well. You know, if I struggle with something, I always find a book which can be helping me deal with different situations and scenarios.
Alex Lee, you're a top man, got a life, and you're living a life driven by purpose. Absolutely. You're a friend first, the client second, and you're still alive, and you're already making my life much better. Mate, I appreciate you very much. Thanks for being a fantastic guest on the Culture of Things podcast.
Thanks, Brendan.
The single greatest quality a leader can have is humility. What is humility? In a nutshell, it's the ability to put other people's interests ahead of your own. Alex Lee epitomizes humility. His behaviors continuously demonstrate how he puts other people's interests ahead of his own. His life and everything he does is driven by his purpose of helping others. As a leader, how are you demonstrating humility? These are my three key takeaways from my conversation with Alex. My first key takeaway: leaders lead with purpose. Simon Sinek's work on purpose and finding your why is well known. Although it resonates with many, most don't take action on it. Finding and living your purpose is the game changer. Alex had found his purpose and he leads with it every day. My second key takeaway: leaders lead with consistency. They're consistent with what they do, how they behave, and how they show up every day. Alex quoted John Maxwell's law of consistency. Discipline leads to habits. Habits lead to consistency, and consistency leads to growth. The best leaders understand it and lead with consistency. My third key takeaway: leaders lead generational change. Think about some of the most famous global leaders: Mandela, Gandhi, Churchill, Luther King. They aren't great leaders just because they were great orators. They're great leaders because they had the foresight to think ahead and lead change that has and continues to impact generations. So in summary, my three key takeaways were: leaders lead with purpose, leaders lead with consistency, leaders lead generational change. What were your key takeaways from the interview? Let me know at theculturofthings.com, on YouTube, or via our socials. Thanks for joining me, and remember, the best outcome is on the other side of a genuine conversation. By the way, if you want to learn more about Alex's tattoos, check out episode 81 bonus content on the Culture of Things YouTube channel. Thank you for listening to the Culture of Things podcast with Brendan Rogers. Please visit brendanrogers.com.au to access the show notes. If you love the Culture of Things podcast, please subscribe, rate, and give a review on Apple Podcasts. And remember, a healthy culture is your competitive advantage.